You're listening to the Fresh Hell Podcast. Fresh Hell contains stories of a disturbing and often graphic nature and is intended for a mature audience. Please don't let your kids listen to this, or they might turn out like us.
I'm Johanna from Austria, and you're listening to your favorite international podcast that covers murder, mystery, and the macabre throughout history. And as you can hear, I'm alone today. Annie and I really tried to record together. We had already everything set up. She's in Atlanta at the moment, preparing for her niece's bat mitzvah. And she, poor Annie, had to schlep all her recording stuff with her, her microphone, her laptop. And for whatever reason, when we tried to record, her microphone just wouldn't work anymore. So you're stuck with me today. But Annie says hi to you and she misses you and she wishes she could be here today. Before I get into part two of the murder of Adrian Hall, I just want to take a quick moment to say thank you to all of our awesome listeners who have been supporting us and who keep supporting us. And of course, a special shout out to our Patreon members who help us to keep this podcast going. And if you want to know more about all the ways to support us or how to contact us, please keep listening until the end, because that's when I'll tell you all about that. Because now it's time to talk about the murder of Adrian Hall, also known as Addie, that occurred in 2006 in New Orleans. And if you didn't listen to last week's episode, please go back and listen to that one first. And if you need a quick refresher, here you go. So last week I told you about the background information of Addie and her murderer, Zack Bowen. Zack Bowen had come to New Orleans as a 17-year-old with his dad, and at 18 he started working at bars in the French Quarter, where he met his future wife, who I called Sarah last week. Sarah had no idea about Zack's real age. She was 9 years older than the teenager. She got pregnant, and the couple married soon after the birth of their first child. A second child was born, and Zack, who was looking for a way to support his young family, enlisted in the US military. He was stationed in Germany and was soon sent to Kosovo and later to Iraq during the Gulf War. The war experience changed Zack. He became ill-tempered, quiet, and moody after his return. He was discharged from the army, and Sarah and Zack moved back to New Orleans, where the couple did split up. Zack started to work at a bar once more, where he met Adrian, Addie Hall. Addie had come to New Orleans from North Carolina. She was a free spirit, an artist, a poet, a seamstress, and a dance instructor. A beautiful, vibrant young woman who too had experienced trauma in her past. At first she wasn't interested in Zack, but he pursued her, and soon the two fell in love. Their young relationship started to blossom right around the time the now infamous Hurricane Katrina formed as a tropical depression near the Bahamas and started to grow and move towards the Gulf Coast and towards New Orleans. And that's pretty much where we left off last week. This week I want to tell you a bit about Katrina and its aftermath and about the horrible and brutal murder of Addie Hall. The sources are pretty similar to the ones last week, and as always, I will post them in the recording album. Also, content note, I will be talking about intimate partner violence, rape, and suicide. So this is a very tough case, particularly tough case. I left off last week just as Katrina made landfall. And we talked about how the mayor of New Orleans, Ray Nagin, had ordered mandatory evacuations. He had also ordered a curfew, and certain locations, like the Superdome, were declared refugees of last resort. Roughly 25,000 people seeked shelter at the Superdome. So, as we said, Katrina made landfall on 29th of August near Bureau's Triumph, Louisiana, with sustained winds of 200 kilometers per hour or 125 miles per hour. The storm surge breaches levees in multiple locations, leading to widespread flooding in New Orleans, particularly in low-lying areas such as the Ninth Ward. Thousands of residents seek refuge in the Louisiana Superdome and the Ernest N. Morial Convention Center as floodwaters rise. But that wasn't going to be the worst of it. On 30th of August, flooding worsens as breaches in the levee system allow water to inundate additional neighborhoods. Search and rescue operations begin across the city as emergency responders work to evacuate stranded residents from rooftops and flooded homes. Communication systems experience widespread failures, hindering coordination of relief efforts. The next day, so on 31st of August, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, also called FEMA, F-E-M-A, and the National Guards begin deploying resources to assist in rescue and relief efforts. Reports of widespread looting and violence emerge, adding to the chaos and insecurity in the city. And then the situation in the Superdome and Convention Center deteriorate as supplies run low and conditions become increasingly unsanitary. Many residents were stranded without adequate food, water, or medical supplies for several days, leading to desperation and tension among the evacuees. With limited security and resources, instances of looting, assaults, and other criminal activities occurred within and around the Superdome. Reports of violence, including shootings and rape, circulated widely, contributing to the sense of chaos and insecurity in the shelter. The lack of law enforcement and emergency services exasperated the situation, leaving many evacuees feeling abandoned and vulnerable. And that is so upsetting because imagine you're a resident, you're following the government's instruction, you evacuate and you seek shelter by going where you're supposed to go, and then the government seems to just not be able to keep you safe there. I have to say that it seems like much of the worst of the Superdome stories were rumors, but even if the refugees had just heard these fake stories, they must have made them feel so extremely unsafe and panicky. And there was still a lot of violence happening around the city. For example, hastily formed militias proved very problematic. So I'm not saying that there was no violence. There was a lot of crime and problems going on, and it was a very unsafe, insecure time in many places. Then the US Army Corps of Engineers begin efforts to repair breached levees and pump floodwaters out of the city. Thousands of residents were evacuated from the Superdome and Convention Center to other shelters and staging areas, though challenges remained in providing adequate aid and transportation. More and more residents were rescued from flooded areas and transported to safety. And of course, there was also a lot of growing concerns about public health and safety due to the reports of disease outbreaks and contaminated water supplies. Finally, around 3rd of September, floodwaters began to recede in some areas of the city, revealing the extent of damage caused by the storm and subsequent flooding. But the destruction brought by Hurricane Katrina extended beyond physical infrastructure to the tragic loss of human life. The storm claimed the lives of over 1,200 people and displaced hundreds of thousands. The social and economic repercussions were profound, revealing the vulnerability of communities to the devastating forces of nature. Katrina really revealed how vulnerable populations, often disproportionately affected, face increased risks during such disaster, and it emphasized the need for profound disaster planning and response. I don't know if any of our listeners out there watched the TV show 5 Days at Memorial. When it came out, I watched it and told Annie to please not watch it. It's very upsetting. It's very upsetting. I'm just gonna say, if you want to watch it, go check doesthedogdie.com first. It's based on the book with the same title written by journalist Jerry Fink, and it chronicles the events that unfolded at Memorial Medical Center in New Orleans during and after Hurricane Katrina. The book focuses on the harrowing decisions made by healthcare professionals at the hospital as they grappled with the chaos and devastation brought by the storm. In the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, Memorial Medical Center lost power, leaving patients and staff stranded without electricity, without air conditioning, and without adequate supplies. And with the floodwaters rising and conditions rapidly deteriorating, medical personnel faced very critical decisions about patient care, including the allocation of limited resources such as ventilators and medication. All right, but now it's time to talk about Zach and Eddie, because as I have told you, the two had decided to stay together at Eddie's apartment in the French Quarter. The French Quarter actually had an advantage. It is situated on relatively high ground compared to the other parts of the city, which helped mitigate flooding, so basically the elevation helped protect it from the worst. The French Quarter is also surrounded by protective infrastructure, including levees and flood walls, which also helped shield it from the brunt of the storm surge and the flooding. And all these defenses provided a level of protection that was not available in other parts of the city. I think staying in New Orleans during and after Katrina gave Zach and Eddie a feeling of, I want to call it survivalism, like they must have felt like they were survivors of a fallen civilization, and it probably also brought them closer together. I read somewhere a long time ago that going through something like a natural disaster or pretty much any other catastrophe, like other life and death situation, can either completely break a relationship or make it way stronger. Plus, I'd assume that not being bothered by mundane problems like, I don't know, going to work, paying bills, unloading the dishwasher, taking care of your children, and not needing to fight about those things that can really take a toll on relationships, you know, they just live day to day, just the two of them and a handful of other people in the neighborhood who had also decided to stay. The group of survivors started to clean the streets and they helped each other, but they also did fun things, you know, like having outdoor barbecue parties in the street. Meanwhile, Zach's family was absolutely devastated and riddled with worry because they still hadn't heard anything from him. They had no idea if he had made it through the storm. And then, slowly, reporters and news teams started to arrive in New Orleans and they started to talk to people who stayed put. For example, in this article in the New York Times titled Holdouts on Dry Ground Say, Why Leave Now? By Alex Berenson, was published on 9th of September 2005. Quote, 10 days ago the water rose to the front steps of their house. 4 days ago it began falling. But only now is the city demanding that Richie Kay and Emily Harris get out. They cannot understand why. They live on high ground in the Bywater neighborhood and their house escaped structural damage. They are healthy and have enough food and water to last almost a year. They have a dog to protect them, a car with a full tank of gasoline should they need to leave quickly, and a canoe as a last resort. They said they used it last week to rescue 100 people. We're not the people they need to be taking out, Mr. Kay said. We're the people they need to be coordinating with. Scattered throughout the dry neighborhoods of New Orleans, which are growing larger each day as pumps push water out of the city, are people like Mr. Kay and Miss Harris. They are defying Mayor C. Ray Nagin's order to leave, contending that he will violate their constitutional rights if he forces them out of their homes they own or rent. We have food, we have water, we have antibiotics, said Kenneth Charles Kindler. We're more or less watching the area for looters. Mr. Nagin had said that the city is not safe for civilians because of the risk of fire and waterborne diseases. There was no official word on Thursday about when the police would start to evict residents forcibly, but officers have been knocking on doors to plead with people to leave on their own. Unless you have enough food or water for 3 weeks, you are a walking dead man, Sergeant George Jackson told holdouts on the northern edge of the city on Thursday afternoon. Some holdouts may change their minds as their food and water runs out. Some appear mentally incompetent or have houses in severely flooded neighborhoods and are staying in the city in the mistaken hope that they will be able to go home in a few days. But thousands more do not fall in any of those categories. They are sitting on dry ground with all their belongings and plenty of provisions. They say they want to stay to help rebuild the city and maybe earn some money doing it, because they have animals they are afraid to leave behind, or to protect their property, or simply because they have always lived here and see no reason to move their lives to a motel room in Houston or San Antonio. Power remains out in most of the city, and even where the tap water is flowing, it's not drinkable. Bathing and using the toilet are daily challenges. Many residents are siphoning water from swimming pools and fountains. Some holdouts seem intent on keeping alive the distinct and wild spirit of this city. In the French Quarter, A.D. Hall and Zachary Bowen found an unusual way to make sure that police officers regularly patrolled their house. Miss Hall, 28, a bartender, flashed her breasts at the police vehicles that passed by, ensuring a regular flow of traffic. End quote. I also found this part of an article from NBC News interesting. It was titled Tribes Find Way to Survive in French Quarter, and it's from 5th of September 2005, and the source is the Associated Press. Quote, with little or no information or outside assistance, groups of rich and poor people banded together in New Orleans French Quarter, forming tribes and dividing up the labor. While mold and contagion grew in the muck that engulfed most of the city, something else sprouted in this most decadent of American neighborhoods. Humanity. Some people became animals. Vasilios Trifonas said Sunday morning as he sipped a hot beer in Johnny White's sports bar on Bourbon Street. We became more civilized. While hundreds of thousands fled the below-sea-level city before the storm, many refused to leave the old quarter. Built on some of the highest ground around and equipped with underground power lines, residents considered it about the safest place to be. "We're the tribe of 12," 76-year-old Carolyn Craig said as she sat on the sidewalk with a cup of coffee, a packet of cigarettes, and a box of chocolate. The tribe, whose members included a doctor, a merchant, and a store clerk, improvised survival tactics. Craig, for example, brushed her dentures with antibacterial dish soap. It had been a tribe of 13, but a member died Wednesday of a drug overdose. The neighbors knew the man only as Jersey. End quote. And there were also a lot of photos of Zach and Eddie that were printed in the newspapers. For example, Hartford Courant on 11th of September 2005, there's a huge photo of Zach and Eddie kissing in front of their home, and it's titled "Coping Any Way They Can." And below the photo it reads, "It was Labor Day, so Zach Bowen, a bartender and musician, and Eddie Hall, a bartender and poet, who had been living together about a month when Katrina hit, celebrated with a kiss in front of the French Quarter house. They had some groceries, beer and wine, but little water and no electricity. They had been dipping into their hot water heater. Hall was not pleased with the heavy military presence in the area. If only we had half as many people that are carrying guns, carrying brooms and cleaning up, we would have the city going in no time," she says. End quote. In another interview, Zach talks about how healthy he feels and how becoming this lifestyle is for him. "I think reporters were really interested in the couple and basically in the whole community of these so-called tribes." And then finally, Zach called his mom and told her that he was okay, but he completely forgot to call the mother of his children. She actually went searching for his name online, scared about what she might find. She really thought he was dead. And what did she find? Well, these articles. She was probably worried sick that her kids had lost their dad. And she then finds out that he's out there having the time of his life and giving interviews left and right, never wondering if she and the kids were okay. Because let's not forget, she went through the hurricane as well. She had to actually evacuate with her children. On 19th of September, Nagin stated that the residents of New Orleans could start to return to their homes if they had any home left to return to, that is. Zach and Eddie, among other people who had decided to stay during the storm, had kind of a disdain for the people they called the evacuees, and they were not really thrilled when those evacuees started to return to their neighborhood, because that also meant that normal life was starting to return. And with normal life came all of life's responsibilities and realities back, like being the father of two children, having to pay child support, and having your kids over every other week. I think a relationship that deepens during such extraordinary times and circumstances can really suffer when normality comes back. I heard similar things about people who had started dating shortly before the COVID lockdowns and who had decided to go through this time together. So Eddie went back to work as a bartender and Zach took a job delivering groceries. Zach and Eddie would party more than ever, drink more, do drugs more regularly, and would also fight more often. That they'd break up and get back together again, break up again, get back together again. The fights became more and more violent. Zach would hit Eddie and she would show up at work with bruises. And the jealousy. Zach would sit around in the bar where Eddie worked and he would rage at her whenever she would be too friendly with a customer. And this is such a huge deal breaker for me, as I used to work in bars when I met my husband, and it was such a green flag, to use a more modern term, for me when I saw that he was not once ever jealous or had any doubt or showed any signs of anger or anything like this because of my work. Like, he was always happy and content, and I think that's so important. Also, the one of the co-workers, or I think the boss of Eddie, heard Zach once tell her, "If I can't have you, nobody will," which is definitely a huge, huge red flag. So yeah, Zach was definitely aggressive and jealous. And the best part of it all, he was jealous all the while he was cheating on Eddie. And this is something I see quite often, that the cheating partner is the one who is also insanely jealous and doesn't trust their partner at all. In German, we have a saying, "Wieder Schelm denkt, so ist er," which translates to kind of "the rascal thinks as he himself is." I'd say it's closest to the pot calling the kettle black, but not quite that. But I think you get what I mean. People who do a thing and then think everybody else is doing the same thing, and that's where they are jealous then. By late summer, Addie had run into some trouble with her landlord. She had financial problems, she was being behind on bills, and I can only assume that the constant fighting had caused quite some complaints by neighbors. The police was called at least at two occasions. So Addie and Zach were looking for a new apartment, and they found one for rent on North Rampart Street, right above a voodoo spiritual temple. Many people have a lot of false conceptions about voodoo, like people are being turned into zombies and human sacrifices or harming others with voodoo dolls and spells and I don't know, these kind of things. But voodoo is a religion that originated in West Africa, and it's what is called a syncretic religion, which means it combines elements of various beliefs, including traditional African religions, Catholicism, and indigenous spiritual practices. Voodoo is characterized by its belief in a supreme creator, spirits who interact with humans, and ancestor worship. Practitioners often engage in rituals, ceremonies, and offerings to communicate with the spirits, seeking their guidance, protection, and assistance. Voodoo rituals can involve music, dance, chanting, and the use of symbolic objects such as candles, charms, and other tools. It is important to note that, as I said before, voodoo is very often misunderstood and misrepresented in popular culture, where it is sometimes portrayed as very dark, very evil. In reality, voodoo encompasses a wide range of beliefs and practices, including healing and community bonding. Just putting that out there. So, Zach and Addie look at this one-bedroom apartment and they rent it. Zach is paying the deposit and first month rent. What Zach didn't know was that Addie had put the lease in her name alone, and now she was kicking Zach out of the apartment and there was nothing he could do about it. And I read comments lately by people online saying that this was a dick move by Addie, taking Zach's money for deposit and rent but having only her name put on the contract behind his back. And under normal circumstances, I would absolutely agree, but we shouldn't forget this was a domestic violence situation. And I can understand why Addie thought it was smart to handle it this way. Where would you go if the lease would have been in both of their names? I'm sure she saw it as means to have like a minimum of protection, if you know what I mean. I mean, she was being physically assaulted, and you need to do what you need to do to protect yourself in that situation. So she was kicking him out, and the couple, or at that moment no longer a couple, started fighting at the apartment. And that fight would last for hours, and it ended by Zach putting his hands around Addie's neck and choking her to death. She was murdered on 5th of October 2006, and she was only 30 years old. After the murder, Zach started to write in Addie's journal, putting down every little detail of what he had done. Quote, "She had stolen this apartment, tried to kick me out, then would not shut the fuck up, so I very calmly strangled her. It was very quick. After sexually defiling the body a few times, I was posed with the question of how to dispose of the corpse." End quote. And the fact that he said she died quickly is, I don't know, it makes me so mad because we know it will take up to 5 minutes for a person to die from strangulation. That's not what I'd call quick. And yes, she was probably unconscious quickly. Zach was a tall, strong guy. But still, it's so cruel how he writes about it so matter-of-factly. And that he was calm while choking her. I mean, I guess at least he wasn't trying to make excuses like, oh my god, I snapped. Or I blacked out and I can't remember what happened. He then fell asleep, only to wake up hours later. He got up and went to work. And there, at the store, his co-workers noticed that he looked a little bit disheveled, but just thought that another night of partying was the reason for that. And when they asked him if he was okay, he told them that Addie had packed her things and left New Orleans for good. He claimed that she had taken some of his savings and gone back to North Carolina. And apparently Addie had talked about leaving the city several times. She said she wanted to move to places like Morocco. So it wasn't something that seemed too far-fetched at the time, even though one friend of the couple later stated that he did get a really bad feeling about the whole thing and that he even wondered if Zach had killed Addie but quickly pushed the thought away. And I can really understand. I mean, who wants to think something like this of their friend, right? Over the next couple of days, Zach would hang out with friends, drinking, talking about travel plans. He wanted to visit Asia, for example. And it seems to me he was trying to find a way to get rid of Eddie's body and run. All the while Eddie was still in the apartment, Zach had turned the air condition on low to fight the decomposition in the Louisiana heat. And this is one of the next entries in the journal. Quote, "I came home, moved the body to the tub, got a saw and hacked off her feet, hands and head. I was to be off all weekend, so I had plenty of time to work. I suppose he means working on disposing of the body. But due to laziness, spent most of the time coked up in various bars with different girls." End quote. The next day, Zach again went out partying with friends, inviting them to strip clubs, generously sharing drugs with them. He had decided to use his savings on a last bender, and once he would run out of the money, he would end his own life. He also burned himself with cigarettes. 28 burn marks were on his body, one for each of his years alive. He spray painted on the walls of the apartment, and I will talk about that in a moment. It was now 17th of October 2006, 12 days after Eddie had been murdered. Zach made his way to the Omni Royal Hotel, used the elevator to get up to the rooftop bar where he would spend the afternoon drinking. He started pacing back and forth up on the terrace. The bar staff started to get worried actually that he would try to run off without paying, and their worry would prove to be correct. Zach ditched the bill, because all of a sudden he was gone. What nobody up at that rooftop bar had seen was that Zach had climbed over the railing and jumped. A hotel guest saw a body lying in the alleyway next to the hotel and contacted the lobby, who called the police. When the police searched the body, they found a Ziploc in his pocket. In it, his military dog tag, a key, and a note. And the note read, quote, "This is not accidental. I had to take my own life to pay for the life I took. If you send a patrol car to 826 North Rampart, you will find the dismembered corpse of my girlfriend, Eddie, in the oven, on the stove, and in the fridge, and a full signed confession from myself, Zach Bowen. I scared myself. Not by the action of calmly strangling the woman I've loved for 1.5 years and then desecrating her body, but by my entire lack of remorse. I've known forever how horrible of a person I am, ask anyone, and decided to quit my jobs and spend the $1,500 cash I had being happy until I killed myself. So that's what I did. Good food, good drugs, good strippers, good friends, and any loose ends I may have had. I didn't contact any of my family. So that will explain the shock, and had a fantastic time living out my days. It's just about time now." End quote. So the police drove over to the apartment and entered, and the walls there were covered in graffiti, and it read things like, "I'm a total failure, call my wife, please help me stop the pain, and look in the oven." There was no blood anywhere, nor did they notice any smell of decomposition. And when they entered the kitchen, they saw the words, "Don't look," spray painted on the oven. And of course the police did look, and what they found was absolutely horrifying. In a pot on the stove they found Eddie's head, in the oven a pan with her legs, and the rest of her body was in a garbage bag in the fridge. Not soon after, the media started to report about the murder, and some stories ran absolutely wild. Rumors of cannibalism and satanic rituals started to circle. The fact that they had lived above a voodoo temple caused people to come up with the wildest theories. There was talk about the apartment being occupied by dark shadows and evil spirits, and that that caused Zach to murder Eddie. I just want to say that there were absolutely no signs of cannibalism. I think the fact that he dismembered her and boiled her body parts were due to his attempts to dispose of the body. This was not a satanic ritual or any other cult-related crime. But I have to keep thinking about their friends and family and how it must have felt when they were informed about what had happened, or maybe even worse, only hearing about it on TV or reading in the newspaper without any prior warning. Over the year that they'd been together, Eddie had made the odd remark here and there to her friends that Zach was not who they thought he was. She said things like, "Everyone loves him and he's considered a good guy, but he's dangerous." And of course you will always see these kind of victim-blaming comments online, like, "Why didn't she leave?" Well, I'd say there are so many individual reasons, But there are statistics that victims of intimate partner violence and domestic violence actually try to break up on average 7 times before finally being able to leave for good. And we all know that the highest risk for victims of domestic violence, of being murdered, is when they are trying to leave. And, I mean, Eddie's story is proof of that. He strangled her when she tried to kick him out of the apartment. And it's very hard to talk about this case and describe both the victim and the murderer and not sound like I'm making excuses for him or excuse any of her behavior. But let's be clear, she is the victim. I don't know. I don't know if it was wartime PTSD that played a part in it, or the drug use, or the fighting, or whatever. But there is no excuse for what he did. He didn't feel any remorse, he said to himself. And he strangled her calmly. And that's the absolute horrifying murder of Adrienne Hall in the wake of Hurricane Katrina. We will be discussing the case and the background of the case a little bit more also in our March get-together with our Murder Tier patrons. If you're interested in that, we're gonna put out the date pretty soon. It's gonna be end of March. Keep an eye on that and let us know what you think of the case. My something good this week is that by the time you are listening to this episode, so tomorrow on Friday, I will be on my way to the airport to pick up my husband who's coming home for 10 days vacation, which is always so exciting. We're gonna go to see the Falco musical once more. He gave it to me for my birthday and we're gonna get a lot of yard work done, I hope, where I need help. Because I need to fill the raised beds with soil. Can't do that alone. And yeah, it's gonna be a great time. I'm so looking forward to tomorrow. And I'm also looking forward to having Annie back next week because this feels so weird doing it alone. I hope you still were able to listen to me without falling asleep. And if you enjoy our episodes, please do us a huge favor. Go to your podcast app, leave us a rating and or review, leave us a comment on our YouTube videos, on our Spotify episodes, send us an email at freshhellpodcast@gmail.com. Join our Patreon if you want to support us that way, or if you have a moment, share our content, suggest us to friends, family, co-workers, or in Facebook groups whenever some suggestions are asked for a podcast like ours. That really helps us a lot. And that's it. Please tell your pets. All of them. We said hi, hug them, kiss them, cuddle them, put them under the blanket if it's still cold where you are, and be kind to them. Be kind to your fellow human being, and the hardest part of it all, be kind to yourself. And as Winston Churchill so famously said, if you're going through hell, keep going. Tschüss.